This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. This is Michael Fremmer, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide, and I enjoyed myself being here, so thank you.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 347 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And yes, I am back from my recent travels. Those of you keeping tabs on my Patreon or Instagram feeds may have seen that I recently went to California. I was on a record hunting road trip in which I brought back many, many, many records. I mean, man, I hit up so many shops, said hello to so many friends, migrated down to the Orange County Record Show, and brought back three huge suitcases of some of the most incredible records of my collection. If you're curious of what I got, go check out my Instagram feed at Vinyl Guide and scroll through the last several weeks. Lots of wonderful loot is shown there. And again, big shout out and thank you to all the people I met, all the listeners that took time to connect with me while I was there, all the record shops and vinyl maniacs. It was great to be back in my element in California. Now, today's episode, I am speaking to vinyl guru and fellow record maniac, Michael Fremmer. Now, most of you know Michael. He's a record collector, reviewer, audiophile, and commentator on physical form media. Michael's currently in the process of relaunching Tracking Angle, or trackingangle.com, as well as a YouTube channel, which I'll link in this episode page. Now, today, Michael and I talk all about the state of the vinyl industry, from the manufacturing challenges to the issues and constraints that may impact record collectors like us in the very near future. Michael and I also talk about the long-term impacts of the Universal Music Fire, the new pressing plants that are going online around the world. We talk about reissues, managing a large record collection, Michael's greatest collectible records, and lots, lots more. I think all you record nerds will really enjoy this conversation. Michael is a fun guy to listen to. Oh, and by the way, there is an extended version of this interview up at patreon.com/vinylguide. I'm always putting extra stuff up there for our supporters, people who take the time to support us with $5 or $10 a month. That's hugely helpful. And we put all sorts of extra stuff up there just for them. This time, I think we've got an extra 20 minutes or so of this interview. Plus, it's commercial free. Plus, it's in high resolution. I mean, double the fidelity of the podcast stream you're listening to right now. Plus, Patreon supporters get these episodes early and with all the extra stuff. So please head up to patreon.com/vinylguide. I mean, this podcast is really just a huge labor of love for me, but this is a way you could help support what we do and keep these episodes going. patreon.com/vinylguide. Sign up now and enjoy all the extras. And finally, if you're new to this podcast, don't forget to subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app and enjoy over 300 conversations, episodes, and interviews, all for record collectors. Episodes like Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, The Small Faces, episode 339 of The Vinyl Guide, episode 334 with Jack Endino, engineer, producer for sub-pop acts like Nirvana, Mudhoney, and more. That's episode 334 of The Vinyl Guide. Jazz detective Zev Feldman, episode 322 of The Vinyl Guide, Alan Parsons, Robbie Krieger of The Doors, Peter Frampton, Amel and the Sniffers, all recent guests with lots to say about vinyl records and collectibles. So subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app, scroll, listen, and enjoy. Alrighty, that's it. Let's talk to Tracking Angle Muckety Muck vinyl ambassador and fellow record collector, Mr. Michael Fremmer. Mr. Michael Fremmer.
Hello there. Do you see me?
I can hear you and see you.
So we got everything.
We are ready to go. Okay. First off, before we start, normally when I have a guest on and I'm asking record nerd questions, I give them a yellow or red card. You know, if you don't know the etchings in the run-out groove, that's okay. But I may have to use those.
Believe me, if I don't know something, I'll tell you I don't know it. I'm not going to try to fudge it.
So, no, I'm worried about me not knowing something that you're talking about.
listen, I don't know everything. And I have this 16-year-old kid that writes for me. And you may know who he is. And I was in the Montreux Jazz Festival last week, and there was a record fair on the lake. And I went to the record fair, and there were things I didn't know. I had to text the 16-year-old kid to find out which records to buy.
So you are still buying records every week. Like, what is your rhythm like on a given week, given month? How many new records are you bringing home?
So I get a lot sent to me, and we should talk about promo records because there's a lot of bad stuff that gets said about that subject. We should talk about that. I go on Discogs and I buy a couple of records a week at the most at this point, because I have a backlog of records, especially now that I'm, you know, I quit Stereophile. You know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You got and a new gig we could talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I quit Analog Planet. So the records piled up and I got no outlet to write about them. So I'm going to be doing a video and to catch up on this many records that I have to catch up on. So the number of new records I'm buying is not that, until I get caught up, there's a guilt feeling that overtakes you. You know, it's the Midas touch, you know, careful what you wish for.
Right.
And so there's a stack of things I really want to cover.
So when it comes to guilt, because I have the same thing with my records, and I've got, I'm sure I don't have as many as you, but I've probably got enough, certainly for the rest of my life, maybe a few others, right? And I look at a lot of these records, it's like, you know, I'm probably not going to enjoy this to the level that I probably should. How do you work through that sort of a collectible artifact guilt?
So the problem is, as a reviewer, I've got to get on to the next record to review. So I listen to a record long enough to be able to absorb it sufficiently so that when I write about it or talk about it, I have something interesting or insightful to say about it. And I know it well enough. And then I have to move on to the next record. Whereas before I started doing this for a living, I would live with a record and play it over and over and just enjoy it and luxuriate in it and really get to know it. I have trouble doing that now. I know when I go back to my old records that I did that with 40 years ago. And I'll do that when I want to really just relax into a record that I know, I can do that. But the newer records I know well enough to write about and talk about and recommend or not recommend.
How do you divide up your time? For example, you've got to listen to these records, I'll say conservatively, 2-3 times maybe to really kind of wrap your brain around them.
And At least.
Yeah. And you've got to do that. I mean, that's 2 to 3 hours maybe and writing about them. At the end of the day, you know, when it's Michael time, you know, you've then got your personal records to listen to. Do you feel like listening to records all the time, or are your ears pretty shot? Like, how do you balance like what your job is and then what your enjoyment is?
Good question. So during the day when it's work, I'll just sit there and go, you know, and you have to go through 20 records to find one that you really want to pay attention to. And the problem is sometimes you make a mistake and you miss something that's really great. Like I missed the first Roxy Music album when it first came out. Mm-hmm. I had it. I got a promo copy of it in 71. And first of all, the cover, the whole thing looked ridiculous because this was the era of, you know, hippies and long hair and mustaches and earth mamas, the whole deal. And these guys come along with this cheesecake cover and they're all dressed in, and I looked at it and said, you know, I don't like this. And I put it on and I didn't get it. That's one of my favorite records now. I listened to that first Roxy Music album. It's like incredible. So I missed that. And that's upset. I'm going to go see them in September. They're playing at Madison Square Garden. Hmm. I paid $700 for 2 tickets, but I really want to see it. So that's how a big fan I am of Roxy Music, but I missed that. I don't like missing records, but it happens. So I'll go through a stack of records and try really carefully to, if I don't like something right away, that's usually a sign I'll probably end up liking it. Unless it's so simple and stupid that I can discard it, you know, and I feel bad about discarding anybody's record that they send me because I get sent a lot of records, not promo records from the labels, but just individual people that make records. I'll get something really great. I got one that I'm going to try to review called it's Black Life Matters. And it's a compendium of new music made by Black people that deals with the politics of today and music of today. And it's really, really good. And I feel like I'm eavesdropping. It's not my scene. I'm not Black, but it's wonderful. And if I was going to publish it on my previous endeavor, there'd be a lot of flack because the people that come there that are politically conservative, if you say anything political. I didn't come here for politics. Even if the music demands that you talk about politics, they get all bent out of shape.
Right. Unless it's their politics, then
yes,
talk away.
The headline would have been Black Lives Matters, and that would have set them off. But I'll do that as a video. So I will not be publishing anything on my new website until probably at the end of August. So okay. I'm going to do video record reviews, which is difficult because I'm much more eloquent as a writer than I am as a speaker. And, but about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, Rick Rubin said to me, did you ever see when Adele gave her Grammy award-winning speech, she got an award and she got up there, she was crying. She said, I want to thank Rick Rubin who gave me all this wonderful advice. And it's only because Rick Rubin gave me this advice that I won my award. And I saw that. And Rick Rubin gave me this advice. I'm lucky enough to say he's a friend of mine. And Rick said, you know, Michael, you're really good on camera. People don't like to read that much anymore. You should do your reviews of records as a video. And I never took that advice, which was really stupid, because if you're lucky enough to get advice from Rick Rubin, even though he compresses his records too much for me, but nonetheless, you take his advice, you try it. I never did it. So now I'm going to have to do it because I have no other way to do it. And it'll be interesting to see when I hold up a record.
So give us the URL, because this will probably go out right before you launch. So perfect
timing. Okay. So the URL is up now as a landing page. And it's trackingangle.com. So, you know, the Tracking Angle was a magazine that I published, and all the 4 years of content from the Tracking Angle are going to be posted on this new site, which is great. And much of that ended up on my previous Endeavors website, but I still own that. They don't own that. So that's going to be there. So it's trackingangle.com. And the YouTube channel is up, Tracking Angle YouTube. It's there. Yep. And I've got 4 videos posted already, and there'll be more coming very shortly.
Great.
So
I'll put those links in the episode page. So
I'm
all right.
Very excited about that.
So you get a record, you get something that, a reissue of a jazz record, let's say Kinda Blue. Do you sometimes replace your originals with the reissues?
You know, I wish I could say that I got rid of records, but I wouldn't get rid of the original. Because it's right. The original artifact, you know. Okay. But this reissue is definitely better.
So you only have records coming in. You don't have many records going out at all.
Oh, I've sold some records. Yeah, I will not sell promo records from labels that are still in business. Like I won't sell anything from Analog Productions. I won't sell anything from Mobile Fidelity. I won't. But if I have classic records or Audio Fidelity records that I don't want anymore, then I will sell them because I need the room more than anything, more than need the money. I need the room.
Right. So in terms of your records, like, do you have some historical ones that you've kept? I mean, obviously you've got some from the industry. I saw a video where you had a special pressing from Paul McCartney, 1 of 100. So you've got,
yeah, that was interesting. That was a funny story. That was what happened was Greg Calvi, the mastering engineer, is a friend of mine. And he does most of Paul McCartney's stuff. And this was in the 90s, I guess. Not that many people were making records. And Paul wanted to make 100 special records for his friends of Flaming Pie. And he wanted them in a white jacket, a white label, and then he would autograph each copy. And so Greg called me and said, what's the best pressing plant in America to get these pressed? Because Paul's very paranoid about bootlegs. So I just want to send it overseas. I said, well, RTI, Record Technology Incorporated in Camarillo is probably the best pressing plant in the country right now. And he said, that's in California. Would you be willing to fly out there with the lacquer and watch it being plated and watch it being pressed and then destroy the metal parts after the 100 records were pressed? And maybe press a few X just in case, in case there were defects. I said, yeah, if they pay me something, I'd be happy to do that. He said, we'll get back to you. So then he said, Paul McCartney's people want your resume. They want to know who you are. So they don't know if they should trust you. I said, okay. I said to them, I have a pretty good resume. You know, I can tell you, it's a good resume. It's really, I've never been in jail. And it's a good resume. And for some reason, it wasn't good enough. It's just disappointing.
Maybe he had Ringo do it.
maybe it's because I was a record collector. You know, they saw that, he collects records. All right. He's taking a bunch of copies, which I wouldn't do. I'm pretty straightforward on this guy. So what ended up happening is at this point, Greg had left Sterling Sound. He was at Master Disc. He's back at Sterling now, but he left Sterling and was at Master Disc for a short period of time. So what ended up happening is the guy that owned Master Disc at the time, he flew out with the lacquer and he watched the whole thing. And that's how it got done. So a couple of weeks later, I open my front door and there's a box there. I open it up and it's a copy of this record. And it came from the guy from Master Disc. And I said, well, that's very cool. You know, I said, if I had done this, I wouldn't have let any extras be pressed. I would have kept my word. But that's cool. Thank you. A week later, another box shows up at my door. It's another copy. This one came from, I guess Don doesn't care at this point. It came from RTI. Thank you for recommending our pressing flames. Our honor to do this for Paul McCartney. So I have two of those. Now, the only thing I haven't done is gotten to Paul McCartney to have him sign one for me, because that would be cool if I could do that.
Those are the only two that are probably not signed by Paul McCartney, I would imagine.
That's right. All the rest are. So maybe it's even more collectible. But yeah. You know. Okay. So then another thing I have here that's kind of cool is this is the first Queen album, the British copy. And so I did the national radio spots for the first three Queen albums for Elektra Records in America. So one day I got this. Remember what airmail used to look like? It was like a thin blue
piece of paper. Yeah, you could fold it out. We still send those to. We still send those around.
You do? I didn't even make them anymore.
No, but, yeah. I live in Australia, and you could actually kind of unfold those, and we have the kids send them to the grandmas. It's very quaint.
Yeah, you don't have that Australian accent, though.
Oh, I'm from California. I moved here when I was well
baby. But you're living there. Oh, yeah. Because you don't have that nasal thing going, you know, the one that's all
blended. No. Anyway. Have you spent much time in Australia?
Yeah, I came to a hi-fi show once. It was great.
Oh, okay.
It was in Melbourne.
Yes.
Melbourne. Right. I'm going friends down there. Anyway, I don't want to make fun of anybody. I do, but I won't. So this shows up. I've got to take this and I've got to preserve this because it's in this record. I put it in this record and it's a letter. It was from the Hotel Bel Air in the Netherlands, but it was crossed out and the person's address is on it. 10 Queensgate, London is on there. He actually stole stationery. And it's from Brian May from Queen.
Yeah.
And he thanked me for the commercials. And he said, I won't read the whole thing to you. Anyway, I wanted to tell you, say thank you for the Queen Sheer Heart Attack tape. You seem to be the only bloke who can really get these things together. In fact, we think your edits are more interesting than ours. Just imagine being a 20-something-year-old kid given this job and then getting a letter. And then, you know, it goes on and on and on and on. Because the publicist gave him some of my funny commercials too, some of the other stuff that I did. And he thought I was really funny and he liked my accents and everything. Anyway, keep up the good stuff and hope to see you next time. Thanks again. Brian May, Queen. He put Queen in parentheses in case I didn't know who he was. That's, you know, and I tell my wife, honey, there's stuff like this in a lot of records. And you should know where those are in case I, you know, the actuarial table. I mean, I'm in good shape for my age, but, you know, I said, these are collectible things, you know. You should.
Do you have a plan for your collection after you pass?
I'm taking it with me.
Okay. Stuff them all in the cremation machine.
Well, there are two, my wife isn't interested in dealing with this because she's convinced that I'm going to outlive her. So, which is probably not true, but you know, that's what she thinks. So this 16-year-old kid that writes for me, I told him he can have any 100 or two, he can take whatever he wants, really, unless my wife needs the money. But, you know, he can have whatever he wants. He's this kid that's come into my life. I don't have kids. I don't have grandchildren. And this kid is a genius writer. And he's helping me with the website. He's a kid that's, he's been friends with Jack White since he was 10 years old. Okay, that's who this kid is. That's unbelievable. I mean, they've been pals. So that's helpful for me because people say, oh, you got this, a friend who's, you met him when he was 12 and he's your good friend. What's up with that? You know, you got to deal with people like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, he's been friends with Jack White since he was 10. Oh, that's okay. Okay, it's okay then. You got cover. Crazy world. At any rate, he can, he's a great writer and he loves music and he's an avid record collector and he knows more about the Clash than I know about the Clash. He's 16 years old. I was on David Bowie's 1972 Ziggy Stardust tour. I was covering it for a magazine. So I flew on the plane with them. I was on the tour. This kid knows more about David Bowie than I know. He can go through all of David Bowie's live albums and tell you which are the good ones based upon the drug abuse, you know, situation of all the different players. And he can do that. Honestly, it's amazing. Anyway, I'm happy to have him have whatever records he wants. Cause this kid is like, he's like the 16-year-old kid friend I didn't have when I was 16. He's like the kid I never had. He's like the grandchild I've never had. It's incredible. So okay. Yeah, he can take whatever. Right. So you're and then sorted. My wife can take that sorted out. And then she can sell the rest. Or if I outlive her, then when it gets to a certain point, I'll sell it to Chad. Chad offered me X amount of dollars for my collection, which is a lot of money. And then everybody said, oh, if Chad offered you that much, it's worth twice as much. So that's a good benchmark for the value.
So you've built a career, you know, really being very steadfast in your opinions and with the ability to see around corners, right?
Luckily.
Yeah, but you've had a high strike rate. Now, if you look at the vinyl landscape, what do you see 5 to 10 years from now? Are we in a vinyl bubble, or do you think it's just going to keep escalating like it is?
Well, we may be in a slight bubble because there are things happening that are not good for it, for its future. It always happens when the major labels get involved. Bad things can happen. And so there are some bad things happening. And there was a period of time when the major labels wanted nothing to do with vinyl. And it was like a joke. And I went to this pressing plant in Gloversville, New York, in the early 2000s. And it was a small pressing plant that Bob Irwin from Sunday's Records had. It was up near where he lived in Coxsackie. He lived in Coxsackie, and this was in Gloversville. This pressing plant was really good. It was making money for Universal, and they decided to shut it down. And I said to the people that I knew at Universal, I said, don't shut this pressing plant down because vinyl's going to make a big – it's making money for you now. Vinyl's going to make a big comeback, and you're going to have a pressing plant that you can – you won't have to wait online like everybody else. Just keep it. Vinyl's not making a comeback. We're just going to. So they sold it. So, and it had a big bump in their bottom line for 1 year because they sold it to United Record Pressing in Nashville. He got all the presses. Thank God they didn't get broken down and destroyed. And now what is Universal doing? They're standing on line to get their records pressed. So the bubble is that a lot of bad records are coming out that are not well press, not well made, not well thought out, bad jackets, you know, all this. So that's a problem. On the other hand, what I'm seeing now, all the studies that have been done, serious studies of who's buying records, it's young people. They like it. They're engaged in it. They're not haphazard collectors. They're not putting the records on the wall to look at them. I mean, some are doing that, but most of them are buying them to play them and hang out with their friends and have a social experience because they live in this world where it's instant turn. And so to have something tangible that has nice artwork and that sounds good and has, it's like something they own. And every time they play it, you know, Google isn't noticing they're playing it and sending them, you know, advertising for some other product related to it. They like that experience. And so I think it's got a very good chance of continuing this way, especially because people are willing to spend a lot of money on good records. You know, the Tone Poet records, they can't make enough of those records. They just sell out. The Chad series for Impulse, Verve Impulse, sells out. They keep selling them, and yeah, people like that.
So the way I'm looking at it, I'm looking at a couple of different factors here. because folks like you and I, we're kind of continuing to get older and older, and at some point we're not going to be around as much anymore. So that's one big market that's not going to be feeding the coffers. The young people who are into records right now, they're into records and they've got money to be able to spend, but at some point they're going to start getting married, they're going to have mortgages, they're not going to have that level of discretionary income to be able to spend around. But and that's why I keep thinking, well, you know, there's a couple of factors, not that it will go away, but it will. I get the feeling, and you could agree or disagree, or if, you know, I'm looking for any sort of input to this theory, that we are in a vinyl bubble. And right now, the people who are buying the, you know, $100 King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard records, at some point, those records are going to have a bit of a crash. Maybe they'll have a revival 35 years from now when those people reach our age and they want nostalgia, if humanity's still around. But that's my thought. I think we're on the cusp here of having another lean period.
There is that possibility. Definitely is that possibility. I think just from what I'm seeing, though, there are two sets of people that are buying records. There's 40-year-olds who have money and have marriages and have kids, and they're buying Tone Poet, they're buying the jazz records, and they're buying a lot of rock records too, because I know those people. And they you know, having kids and having whatever, they're finding, they have money to put into records. They're fanatics. Then once they got involved in it, they love it. And the young people I talk to also, they're real collectors. They have a collection of records. They have it on the wall. You know, how many records did I have when I was 20? I had records in two like cases. I didn't have what I had. I had two cases of records. I bought a record every week, maybe one a week. That's all I could afford. Right. I think kids will have money to buy one record a week, okay. And they'll learn to be more discriminate as they get older. They'll be more careful what they buy. They'll get burned on a couple of records and they'll get rid of those records. I did that. I bought records that turned out to be bad and I got rid of them.
And some of them I ended up buying again and realizing that I really shouldn't have got rid of it in the first place.
Let's talk about those records. I had Song, Stories, and Pictures of the Beatles on VJ in stereo, VJS 1092S. That record's worth like $500 now. And I had it and it sounded great. And it had the fold out. But on the back, it said, Paul loves, paste your picture here. John loves, paste your picture here. And I was going to college. And I just said, you know what? This is not appropriate for a college kid. And I sold it for a dollar. Terry Reed's The River. I had that record. I never liked it. I got rid of it. Then I started reading in Mojo. Terry Reed's The River. This is a genius record. So I had to buy it again for $40. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff happens.
It's funny, you remember the records that you passed up, like you more than sometimes the records that you bought.
Okay, name one. Name them and I'll name one.
Oh, John Frusciante, Shadows Collide with People. I had that in my hand for $19 one time, and I love his work. I love his album, and I think I probably put it down to buy a Dead Kennedys record. And now that record is, $400 or $500. And now I refuse to pay that for it. Because in my mind, it's $19.
Yes. I had Space Oddity, David Bowie on Philips, the original British pressing, in my hand at a record store I worked at in Boston. And I said, I know that song is really great, but I don't know the rest of these songs, so I want to pay $4.98 for an import. It's a very collectible record. I had the record that the Beatles did All Across the Universe, a different version of it that was on a benefit record charity for some kind of ecological thing. And I said, gee, I know the Beatles song, but I'm not going to buy this record because I don't know the rest of it. That's a very collectible record.
What's the most you've ever paid for a record?
I paid $100 for the Velvet Underground record when I was in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And buying expensive records is not fun. Fun is finding expensive records for not too much money. So at this point, I'll spend $100 on a record. If it's something like that Velvet Underground record, I wanted it. I wanted it. I found it for $250 on Discogs. I didn't want to spend $250. When I saw it in mint condition for $100, I bought it.
Right.
You know, at this point, life's too short. You know, say life's too short. Well, at this point, life really is too short. And I have the $100, so I'm going to buy that record. So,
if you look at the record landscape right now, all the pressing plants are backed up. You know, they're working three shifts. They still can't keep up with the backlog. And
that's changing, though.
They're expanding. Yeah. What's it going to look like after everything settles down? What sort of impact do you think is going to have on the vinyl industry when everything kind of gets a little bit more predictable?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, record nerds. Don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress. No
limits. If you look at the record landscape, right now all the pressing plants are backed up. You know, they're working three shifts. They still can't keep up with the backlog. And
that's changing, though.
They're expanding. Yeah. What's it going to look like after everything settles down? What sort of impact do you think is going to have on the vinyl industry when everything kind of gets a little bit more predictable?
Well, again, it depends on who you talk to. There are those people that say this is going to be really great because they're finally going to get caught up and they'll be able to make better records. You know, there won't be so many bad records coming out because they won't be so stressed out about getting them done. And then there are the other people that say the bubble's going to burst because we're at the peak is now. And so all this infrastructure is being built, all these pressing plants are coming online, and then it's all going to disappear because everything's going to be digitally recorded. So who cares? Mm-hmm. But I'm not convinced about that because I think part of the experience, you know, there's a big study that was done by a very serious research group about vinyl. And it was not a little group of people doing this because they're vinyl fanatics. It was done by a big research company that wanted to understand this marketplace. And what the study showed is that the demographic is young. It's, you know, 20 to 40 is really where the most of it is, with, you know, older people buying some records, but it's 20 to 40, 45. Why are they buying the records? Sound quality. That was number one, which totally surprised me. Sound quality, artwork, packaging, the thing. Those are the two things. And so I really think that if people get used to buying records and they enjoy the experience, even though they can stream everything now anyway, that's the point. They can stream for almost nothing on Spotify every song that they're spending money to buy on vinyl, even if the vinyl's from a digital source.
Right.
But they're buying the vinyl anyway because they like having the shelf. They like having the records. They like the social aspects of it. They like having friends over. And they'll sit around and smoke a joint. It's legal now. I'm not a criminal anymore for the first time in 50 years. And they'll sit around and smoke a joint and talk about the music. And I hang out with guys that are like in their 40s who I'm as old as their parents. I'm as old as their grandparents, actually, which is freaky. And we hang out. The living room has a wall of records, a really nice stereo, a nice amplifier, no television. The television's in a bedroom. And we hang out and we play records and we talk about them. And it's just the most fun. And it's what I did in the 70s that they do now. And they're not going to stop doing that when they get older. And their kids are into it now, too. The kids love it.
Yeah.
So I'm very optimistic about this. I don't think it's a thing. That's what I always maintain. You know, people have book collections. It's a thing. Books are not going to go away because they're Kindle. And to me, records, having a record collection, it's a thing. You know, you walk into someone's house, they have a record collection, you walk over to it, what's in the collection? I know that person now. What is he like? Now I have some idea who that person is.
Yeah.
You can't do that with, oh, you can take your iPad and look at what's on their iPad, the stream. And I stream also. I'm not against streaming. It's a great way to find out what to buy. But there's something about having a collection of records, pulling off the shelf what you want to play. I have 8,000 files on a NAS drive. You know, people say, "Oh, you have a NAS drive with it. You have digital." You have, yeah, you know, But I write about vinyl, but I have digital. I enjoy listening that way, not as much as records. When I come down at night, you know, you were talking about what do you do during the day? What do you do at night? So during the day, I work and it's work. At night, I come down and I play what I want to play for pleasure. It's yeah. never a file. It just isn't. It's always a record, because to me, taking the record out, putting it on the turntable, playing it, turning the light out, but having enough of a light on so I could see it spinning around, that's my comfort zone, and it gives me the greatest pleasure. And it's 20 minutes, perfect length.
Yeah, yeah. I always think that the brain's got about 20 minutes before it needs to reset anyway.
So, and it's true.
Yeah.
Just by coincidence, the record is the ideal way to listen to music, you know, as a physical entity and as a sonic entity. And you were saying, so what records would you pull out? So this is this Beach Boys compilation that just came out, which showed up in the mail. Before I left. And so it's a compilation of Sounds of Summer, and it's very well curated by Mark Linnet, who's like the curator of Beach Boy tapes, kind of. Mm-hmm. A lot of remixes. I don't know why would you have to remix I Get Around? That was a great sounding stereo song to begin with. Why Don't Worry Baby, that was a great sounding original. Why did he do I haven't played it yet. I want to know why it had to be remixed. Some of it, I understand why they do remixes, but why did that have to be remixed? I want to find out what he did to it.
Yeah.
You know, In My Room, have you ever heard the Analog Productions reissue of In My Room? It's spectacular stereo, real stereo recording. Why was it remixed? Didn't have to be remixed. It wasn't like there were mistakes in the mix. But anyway, this is good because the original records were like not really meant to be albums. You know, there were Beach Boys singles that they had to put an album out, so they did a lot of crap and added it to it. You know, do I want to hear "To Hawaii, Hawaii"? I don't really want to hear that, but it's on that record. I got to hear that to get to the good songs. So this looks like an interesting compilation, but it's digitally remastered, and it was done at GZ Media, and it was mastered at GZ Media. It wasn't mastered by somebody here from the files. And GZ Media can do a good job, but they tend to cut for the lowest common denominator so that they can actually look at the file and see where the problematic tracks are that might track on a cheap turntable, and they will make it so that it'll track on a cheap turntable. So I'm not 100% optimistic about the sound of this, but I'm going to play it and find out.
Are there more record pressing plants coming to life in Asia? Like, do we know if there's some coming out of China?
There are pressing plants in China that are not very good as far as I know. And they do a lot of bootlegs, a lot of pernicious, bootleg stuff that is not good. As far as what's happening here, so Rick Hashimoto, who was at RTI for many years, is opening a new pressing plant in Oxnard with his son and with Mobile Fidelity. And it's going to have SMT presses, the real big, heavy presses that they have at RTI, because that's his comfort zone. So that pressing plant is going to take a lot of the pressure off of RTI. So they'll press Blue Notes there. They'll press MoFi's there. That'll be good. It's going to come online later this year. There's a pressing plant in Boulder, Colorado, that Vinyl Me Please is opening. And that is being done by the greatest plating guy that there is used to work for Chad. He's opening that pressing plant in Denver. That's going to be a good one. So their records are really going to be good sounding. Then United Pressing, Record Pressing, has always been the bad boy on the block. It's the biggest pressing plant, and it's always pressed the worst records. In fact, you say I speak my mind. So there was an event at an Exponer show about 10 years ago, and it was in an amphitheater kind of place with like 100 people there. And I'm sitting on the panel, and I says, "What's the best pressing plant in America? And what's the worst pressing plant in America?" And I said, "Well, the best pressing plant is RTI at this point. It's a small 10 press boutique pressing plant. They make the best quality records. They were doing the Music Matters, and they were doing all the high quality records. And the worst is United Record Pressing. It's horrible. And the guy that owns it was right in the audience. He was not happy with me, but it was true. And he had just bought the whole place, and it was a mess. Now, I did a tour of it when I was down in Nashville for the Making Vinyl event. he's stepping up to the plate. He's spending the money. He's updating the entire infrastructure. He's got new presses coming from Europe and refurbishing all the landed presses that he bought from Rainbow and all new infrastructure of boilers and the way the steam runs and the water exchange, everything totally redone, all new plating. And he hired an expert who came from Sony who was involved in the Blu-ray production, which is very high, you know, high quality. Mm-hmm. And it's, I'm quite convinced they're going to end up making world-class records. I'm hopeful they're trying, they're putting the money into it. And I'm really hopeful that's going to happen. And then there's another pressing plant, Nashville Record Pressing. That's another GZ affiliate. Mm-hmm. They're opening a new pressing plant. And I was at the opening party. I got there late, but I'm going to go back at the end of July.
So we, a couple of years ago, there was the Apollo lacquer fire. Yep. You know, we've seen a lot of lumpiness in the whole supply chain. What is the current weak link in vinyl production at this point?
Okay, so here's an interesting thing. So I live in New Jersey, and in 1986, I moved back from California, and I found out that Transco Lacquers was in Elizabeth, New Jersey, right down the road. So I called them to come visit. And they, first of all, they said, why would you want to come visit us? I said, I want to do it. So I went and I visited Transco, and it was great, but there was no video cameras at that point in time, you know? So I just took still shots, and I don't know where those pictures are. I have one picture, but it was fascinating to watch that. And then they sold it to Apollo and they moved the line there. So that both lines were operating in tandem. It wasn't like they subsumed one company into the other. And I said, at the time, I said, what happens if there's an earthquake? They're both in one place. A fire wasn't something that I thought of, even though this is very flammable stuff. And that was a disaster, obviously, but the lacquer company in Japan stepped up to the plate. Now there's no shortage of lacquers, as far as I know. So the next shortage was, the last shortage was nickel. You know, nickel pellets are used in these vats where the silver-plated lacquers go to become stampers. Mm-hmm. The nickel gets adhered to the thing. So there was a nickel shortage because of Ukraine. It's like, what else could there be? So the next shortage, that's been solved. Everybody says to me, oh, yeah, there's a shortage, but it just takes money. Put more money in and you get nickel. So that has been solved. So the other problem is, qualified press people is a problem. People that can actually operate the presses and that are dedicated to it. And so when I was at making vinyl in Nashville, I said, what you guys need to do in Nashville is, you know, the state of Tennessee is thrilled about this investment, and the city of Nashville and the city of Memphis, they're all thrilled about these investments. The state of Tennessee has to go to the community colleges, and someone has to establish a course in the skill set involved in becoming a good press person to operate the presses, and they have to be paid a living wage, because the way it is now, they hire people off the streets, they show them what to do, and these guys do this job for a while till their feet give out, and then they say, I'm not doing this anymore, and they leave. It's got to become a job, not what it is. So that's another issue. The other issue is the people that make the cutting stylite for the lathes, that's an issue, but that's apparently being addressed now. Also, all of these things are being addressed because as soon as there's money in something, as soon as there's a notion that there's a future in this, then everything else flows into it.
I hear all the styluses, or majority of the styluses that are on all of our turntables, are made out of one factory in Japan. Is that right?
No.
Okay.
No. So there are two major ones. There's Namiki and Agura, and they make the highest quality ones. But there are also, there's Geiger in Switzerland. There's Peter Letterman at Soundsmith gets his from another source. There are other sources. There's a guy in China now that's making pretty good ones, mostly spherical ones, but that's okay. There are people that are doing this now. And
okay.
There is a concern that the Agora people are getting older and they're just going to quit doing it. But I think it's a viable business again now. And so, and certainly with all the records that are out there that are not going away, and enough people value records and they'll want stuff to play them back on. I don't think that's really a problem. Right. The cutting thing was a problem. And the other problem was the fabrication of the metal parts. Once they get made, there were these specialized machines that prepare them to be put on the presses. And a lot of this is very, very old. If you go to the, went to the pressing plant like 20 years ago, all these things are really old machinery, and you know, everything's green. Everything was, it was like an, everything had to be green like 40 years ago. Everything in lathes was green. Everything in this was green. But now all the companies that did Blu-ray, a lot of the companies that are doing Blu-ray prep are now adapting their stuff to be used to make stampers, and it's a higher quality. So the stampers are getting better because the infrastructure is getting better in that side also.
So if you compare record production now to maybe the 60s where you had Plastilite and some of the companies that were pressing these beautiful records, would you say that we're missing something in today's record pressing environment that they had back then? Or are we just light years ahead of that right now? Maybe we don't realize it.
You know, it's interesting because I have a lot of great records from those days, really wonderful, especially the English records, the imports, the English and German and some other European. Those were amazing records. What came out of America was a mixed bag. There were some good presses and some not such good, you know. And I didn't, you know, I buy Atlantic records. I lived in New York. I'd buy records from Atlantic. And I would notice that the rim was different on certain ones. But I didn't understand what that all meant. I didn't know that there was Monarch and there was Presswell. I didn't know all that stuff. But there were a lot of bad records pressed back then. And there were so many records being pressed. So I can't say that it was better then. I think it's actually, in a lot of ways, better now. There are problems now with eccentric pressings, but there were that problem then too. The vinyl pellets were in some ways better then, but now they're better again. Mm-hmm. You know, the British records and the Japanese, British records from the 60s and Japanese records from the 70s and 80s were the epitome of great record pressing. You could almost guarantee you buy a Japanese or a British pressing, it was going to be great. But you could also guarantee if you bought an American pressing, it was going to be pretty mediocre. If you were lucky, you got a good one. That was my take. You know, I went to, in the early 60s, I became a jazz fan. And I remember to get into New York to go to Sam Goody's, I had to get on a bus at my corner, take it to the end of the line and get on a train and go into Manhattan and walk a bunch of blocks, get the Sam Goody, buy the record, come home, put it on the turntable. And I remember this Modern Jazz Quartet record called Pyramid that I really like. I put it on and I started, and it's very quiet music. You know, it's almost like drawing room music. It just would do that and have a little warp in it. I said, I can't. I paid $6 for this record. I'm going to go back. So to go back, I had to get on the bus. I had to take the train into Manhattan. And Manhattan was scary for me as a little kid in the suburbs. And I'd go and I'd say, this record has a defect. And the guy put it on the turntable and said, okay, here's another copy. I'd get that copy home, same problem. When they didn't realize that when they press 1,000 records or 500 records, they're all going to have that problem. I didn't understand how this worked. And so the second one I kept until I finally got a Japanese pressing of it. Years later, that was perfect. But
we've seen the company that's trying to do HD vinyl. And I know high def vinyl, it's very, you know, they're using the name, it's not high definition, but they're right. They're trying to go with this new format of stamping out records. They've got some good ideas, I think. Do you think that's a real thing? Do you think we'll see that in reality one day?
We'll be back after these messages.
Psst. Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. Rather than running our sponsor ads again, can I give a plug for our Patreon page here? Patreon.com/vinylguide, where right now there is an extended interview and it's totally commercial free. And quite frankly, you know, I'm sure you all know podcasts only really exist because of the support of the audience. And that's what I'm here to ask you for. Please consider supporting the show, $5 or $10 a month, whatever you can afford. Because if you're listening to this now, some into the episode, that's great. You're enjoying it. I'm glad you're enjoying it. For that, I would ask you to please consider supporting the show. Patreon.com/vinylguide. It's super important. It's like a direct lifeline to us here. And it's a huge signal, and the support is so welcome and helps keep this podcast going. Each week, I put extra stuff up there, extended interviews, and it's all ad-free, and it's early, and it's all that kind of stuff. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you politely, please support the Vinyl Guide, patreon.com/vinylguide. All right, that's it. Back to the show.
No limits.
We've seen the company that's trying to do HD vinyl, and I know high def vinyl, it's very, you know, they're using the name, it's not high definition, but they're
right.
They're trying to go with this new format of stamping out records. They've got some good ideas, I think. Do you think that's a real thing? Do you think we'll see that in reality one day?
Every time I see them, they've made more progress, and they actually showed me last time I saw them. And what they're doing, we should say what they're doing. So what they're doing is they're using a laser to take the digital file and cut a stamper out of a ceramic material. So you can just take that and make records from it. It's like a one-step process, actually.
Right.
And it should be the most accurate rendering of the digital file. Of course, you got to start with a digital file. So if it's an analog source to begin with and you want all analog, then you're out of luck.
Tough tacos.
The same with the plangent process. You know about the plangent process where you digitize an analog tape, and using an algorithm, they can remove all of the scrape flutter and all kinds of other issues that tape definitely has. But in order to get to that point, you've got to digitize it first. So if you don't like what that does, you know, the globally digitizing analog changes it. Some people think it's transparent to the source, but it's not. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's gotten better over the years. It's gotten to the point now where someone sent me Miles Showell's half-speed mastered cut of Roxy Music's Avalon, which is one of my favorite records. So I've got an American original cut by Bob Ludwig. I've got a British pressing. I've got a Japanese pressing. I've got a Bulgarian pressing. And to me, the British pressing is the best one. And Bob Ludwig's pressing has a lot of good qualities to it, but the bass is not great. Mm-hmm. This half-speed mastered from digital is really good. I have to say, I could listen to this all day. The bottom end is taut and punchy and well. It's a digital recording to begin with. People don't realize that. It was recorded on a Mitsubishi X800 and then mixed to analog tape, but it's got digital qualities to it.
Right.
But this reissue, it sounds great. Yeah, I know it's digital because I can hear the certain thing about it, but it's gotten so good that it's a trade-off to me that could be worth making with this record. It's good.
Right. Okay. But back to what this HD vinyl is, where they're cutting it and they're you know, the science behind it. We did a whole episode on it. We had
Science behind it is good. The practicality of it is obviously problematic for them because it's been many years now and they still haven't done it. I think they showed me a 10-inch or a 7-inch that they had that they showed me that's cut using that system. And they keep coming back. Every time I see them, they say, well, it's getting better. We're getting further down. We're almost there, but you know.
Have you heard it? Have you only seen it?
Okay. Only seen it.
What do you think the long-term impacts of that universal music fire will have on vinyl production?
Okay. So first of all, as it turns out, while there were a lot of tapes that were burned, far fewer tapes were burned than they originally thought. And the New York Times story on it was absolutely not accurate. And they should issue a retraction, but they refused to do it, which is disappointing to me. But a lot of the tapes, as it turns out, were actually being moved at the time of the fire. They were in transit to a more secure location. And so the New York Times story said the Buddy Holly catalog was burned in the fire. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, because Chad released a few Buddy Holly records cut from the original tape, and he sent me pictures of the tape. And those reissues sound fantastic. And so you know it. There's another reissue series coming out that I'm not at liberty to talk about that everybody will go crazy for, that was supposedly burned in the fire. The Verve Impulse series that Chad's doing now, supposedly the Verve tapes were burned in the fire, but most of them weren't.
Okay.
And I saw the tapes. So yeah, so a lot of the Motown catalog was burnt, but not all of it, because Marvin Gaye's What's Going On was released on a one step from the master tape. And Kevin Gray did a version of it cut from the master tape. So yeah, a lot of good things were lost, but not as much as we thought. And also, a lot of these tapes were duped to send overseas to, you know, to master vinyl back in the day. So a copy of the master is in England, a copy of the master is in South Africa, a copy is the master. And so they're busy scooping up those copies, trying to get them back.
Okay.
So it was a tragedy. It never should have happened, but it wasn't as big a tragedy as we thought.
I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, the equipment that was originally used to make the DMM records was scooped up at one point by the Church of Scientology. I know just even saying that makes me feel like I'm wearing a, you know, aluminium hat, but
you've gone clear. You've gone clear.
What do you know about that?
Okay, so first of all, it is true. Secondly, they scooped up a whole bunch of them, and also they built a state of the art plating facility at RTI, and that's in great part what kept RTI afloat during the downturn in vinyl.
This is in the 90s, so they actually gave money to RTI to rent part of their environment just for this. Okay.
So the Scientologists, they're audiophiles. A lot of them are like, you know, Tom Cruise is a serious audiophile. He's got a huge audio system. He's a vinyl fanatic. He buys records from Chad, a lot about from Analog Productions. It's part of their thing for some reason. Mm-hmm. And what they did with the DMM lathes is they took all of L. Ron Hubbard's speeches, cut DMM parts, invented a plating process that turns the plated record into like a pop top can. So it's hermetically sealed with a tab, and you peel it back and you play it on a solar powered turntable that has a cartridge with no elastomer in it. So over time it will not deteriorate. So it could, you know, last for hundreds of years and it won't deteriorate. And this is true. And all of this is stored in the Mojave Desert in a bunker. And, so
have you seen one? Have you seen it working and functioning?
No, but okay. I've heard from some of the people that were originally going to design the cartridges, and I've spoken to some of the people who sold their lathes to them. So I know it's a real thing. So, you know, what's going to happen is in however many thousand years it takes, all of a sudden our civilization will end, which it's going to be very soon. And then when the next one comes along, they will discover this thing, and they'll open the vault and they'll learn how to play these records. And eventually they'll learn the language and they'll go, you know what? This L. Ron Hubbard was the most important person in their civilization, because look at the trouble they went to preserve his brilliant
teachings, right?
Teachings. Whereas everything else was saved up on some sort of digital format that really had no legs.
His speeches sound horrible in streaming.
Yeah. But that's what's going to happen.
You seem to have the ability to listen to a record and recall the qualities of that record, sometimes for months or even years, and to be able to compare them. So you listen to a copy of Tommy today, you can compare it to a copy that you've heard years ago. I always find myself having to A-B, like if I need to listen to it right away to be able to, you know, reset my ears and really hear the true difference. Is that, am I reaching there? Is that something an uncanny
ability? I don't have that ability because I find my system has changed so much over the years that if I pull out a record that I haven't played in like 30 years, I have a definite expectation of what it's going to sound like. But on my system as it exists now, it's usually, whoa. Actually, this is a great sounding record. I thought it sucked. Or I thought this record sucked. This sounded great, but it really is not a very good recording. I mean, that always happens frequently. Yeah. I've got a mindset of like what the original British track pressing of Tommy sounds like. And it's a very special pressing. And I have the classic records we issue cut from the master tape. It's also very good. But there's something special about that original track record that's...
All the track records I have sound like garbage. I've got a lot of the Jimi Hendrix ones out of the UK. I've never liked the way the track sounds. And I always assumed it was because, you know, the guys who were leading track, I think they were the Who's managers, if I recall right. They were just kind of skimping on the manufacturing. Am I wrong about that?
Well, the Jimi Hendrix Electric Ladyland The best one was the original American, actually. And the English one was a copy of the tape. And they, whoever did it was not in charge of the catalog. It was somebody made their own mastering choices. So that version is kind of weird sounding. The American one, the original American one, is probably the best one.
The first records that are off any stampers, are those typically set to the side and sold at a premium?
You can't say those are the best, though, because anyone that presses records will tell you when you turn this press on in the morning, it's not the best records right away. It's like okay. Hours later or an hour later or a certain amount of time when the thing's warmed up and ready to rumble that you get better records. And then if it's a hot day and the transfer of the cooling tower isn't transferring cooling the water down properly, you don't get the best record. So it's really hard to say. So, I'll say this about Tom Ford. And back in the day when people were pressing so many records, if you want to go through 500 copies to find the best one and sell it for a premium, I'm all for that. But some of what he sells as, and there's no such thing as a hot stamper. It's really a matter of what happens to be the best sounding version of a record or which copy came out best. But that's fine. I have no problem with that. But some records, there's no good copies of. So there's no good copies of, like, if he wants to sell a uni pressing of Elton John's second album, the one that's got your song on it, there are no good copies of that, because uni, when they mastered that, they lopped off the bass at 80 hertz and there's no bass on that record. If you get a British Dick James pressing, it's heavenly. That's the one to get. So, right. But people have played me some of his ones, hot stampers, and they're good. We don't hate each other. He may hate me. I don't hate him.
Oh, I didn't even know there was any feelings like that. I just thought, okay, once the record presses get warmed up, there's got to be some sort of arc or understanding where they say, okay, the record's pressed between after 11 o'clock and before 2 o'clock when everyone's kind of hitting that coffee, grunge. Those are better than the ones on either side of the day. I would imagine that would be kind of known within each record pressing plant. Maybe not taken advantage of by saying, oh, these ones we should get an extra 20% for. But yeah, that is a possibility, yeah?
Yeah, they don't do that just because the problem of pressing and stacking them and handling them and taking them to the back room where they let them cool off and then they package them. Nobody
too
wants
hard to organize.
Out.
Right. Okay.
And then you don't want to play each one,
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show today and giving us a lot of information and stories on vinyl records. I've always watched your videos, and I'm very excited about this new opportunity you have coming up, thetrackingangle.com. Is that the right URL there?
Just trackingangle.com.
Trackingangle.com. And there's also a YouTube channel to subscribe to.
That's up and running. Yep. That's up and running.
And all those links will be in this episode page. And Michael, again, please come on the show anytime. We'd love to talk records and vinyl and hear those bizarre stories around the hobbies that we love.
It was great being on your show. You're a really great host. You're a gracious host. And so I would be happy to come back sometime and do it again.
Thanks so much, Michael. All right. See you around. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Oh, man, that interview went way too quick. We got to have Michael back on. I'm sure we will at some point. But in the meantime, you can go to trackingangle.com, sign up for Michael's updates, and hell, that site may already be live right now. He's also got the YouTube channel, which I'll link in this episode page. Subscribe to his YouTube, and you can always enjoy Michael talking on about the records he's reviewing in his life. Again, all those links will be in this episode page. And if you want to hear more of this interview, go to patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support this podcast. Get the extended interview and get all the extras. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for downloading and listening, and everyone for all your support. Again, I fully encourage everyone to share these episodes on their social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, tell your record nerd buddies about them. Make sure the folks that work at your local record shop have heard of The Vinyl Guide. That is always hugely helpful. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.